Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Often, the Western media portrays Sweden as a sort of modernist utopia, where blonde-haired trendmakers export up-tempo pop music, hip furniture, whilst the government offers up unparalleled maternity leave and a long history of generous immigration policies. I have myself at times joked to my wife, we should just move to Sweden, as though life itself would simply be easier there. But this is not how Sweden is depicted in Michael Booth's new book, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. Booth is British-born but has lived in Denmark for many years now, and in his book he wryly describes Swedes as a stiff and conformist people paralyzed by good manners and their government as a sort of benign totalitarianism. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing, Taylor?
I'm very well. So, Michael, as I started out by talking about how the Western world sees Sweden, can you tell me how Sweden is viewed by the rest of Scandinavia?
Well, that's the interesting thing, really. I mean, that's kind of why I started to write this book many years ago, was that when I moved to Denmark, I discovered there was this weird kind of dysfunctional family relationship up here with the Swedes. They're kind of like the older brother, the head boy, the goody-goody. They've generated quite a deal of resentment amongst their neighbours and envy over the last couple of hundred years, really. So it was that kind of weird relationship that got me started. I mean, basically the Swedes won. They won history. They won everything. They're rich, successful. They won the territory. They had these massive global brands. They had this amazingly well-functioning secular industrial society. And they have remained neutral for a couple of hundred years, supposedly, whilst selling arms to the rest of the world. There's a good deal of kind of accusations of hypocrisy from the Finns and Danes in particular. The Norwegians don't like them terribly much either.
Now, you did a lot of traveling through Scandinavia. You live in Denmark, but you visited all the other countries. And Sweden especially has a very interesting stereotype of a person who's, as I mentioned, stiff, very conformist. Did you find that was the case in your experience?
Well, yeah, and it's not really me that's kind of decided this. If you ask the Swedes themselves, this is their self-image. It's quite interesting. When there are international surveys done for people to describe themselves in adjectives, the Swedes just use words like stiff, remote, humorless. They don't have a very great self-image compared to the Danes, who always describe themselves as the happiest people in the world. And the Swedes do tend to live up to some of their stereotypes. Greta Garbo famously wanted to be alone. She was a Swede. Mm-hmm. I always used to think that was just kind of some kind of shtick, but it's true. The Swedes do have isolationist tendencies. It is a huge country, a huge landmass, and they have traditionally lived kind of spread apart, not very densely populated. So they're used to getting by themselves. They also have what's called a very high context society, which means that they all are kind of homogenous. They think the same, they eat the same food, drive the same cars, wear the same clothes, see the same films. They think in the same kind of way. In the book, I have a rather kind of flippant chapter where I go to Stockholm and spend a day trying to behave as un-Swedishly as possible.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories from that chapter is where you visited the Nobel Museum and sort of tested their manners.
I ate a pack of potato chips and slurped my Coke underneath a sign saying no eating or drinking. And I also tried to cross the road on red, which is just not done generally in Scandinavia, and would sidle up to people on benches and try and start a conversation or get into a lift with Swedes and see them leave rather than share a lift with me. They're just not very social people. And again, this isn't really me going there and saying, pointing the finger. It's the Swedes themselves. I interviewed their greatest ethnologist, Åke Dahn, who's like the expert on Swedish mentality. He literally wrote the book on it. And he told me he did a similar experiment once where he's been living in the same lovely part of Stockholm for decades and would see the same people on the streets every day, and they'd ignore each other studiously. And so he decided to say hello out of the blue. And he was overwhelmed with the positive response. It was such a revolutionary thing for a Swede to do.
Now, do you think the qualities that the Swedes use to describe themselves, you know, polite, conformist, later you talk about lacking in chivalry, do you think these are necessary trade-offs required to live in such a successful welfare state like they do?
No, not really, because there are other successful welfare states in Europe that do without that kind of, you know, I'm English, right? So I'm used to these rather baroque, extreme forms of manners, which I agree are kind of, you know, weird. But if I go into a store in Britain, and I've done this, and I've counted how many times in a transaction to buy a newspaper, how many times you say the word please and thank you. It's like 12 or 13 times. It's all, excuse me, please, thank you. Well, so we have a good welfare state, and we're chatty, right? The Swedes have a fantastic welfare state. They're not chatty. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Well, so you don't think that there's any connection maybe between the sort of isolated sensibility that they hold and the way that the dependent on the state rather than each other?
No, I think more it's a case of high trust societies tend to create a kind of social network, a social kind of foundation in which welfare states flourish very well. Because if you trust each other, if you trust your government and authorities to administer your taxes fairly and to redistribute the wealth fairly, then those welfare states tend to function much better. And that you can see across the Nordic countries, they have high levels of social trust, high levels of social cohesion. The Swedes and the Danes belong to more clubs, associations. They do more voluntary work than almost anyone else in the world. And that certainly helps to knit the fabric of society very closely together.
How does this all connect to the very different history? They're descendants of Vikings, and yet they're now, you know, the most polite peoples we can sort of imagine. How does that all connect?
Well, actually, they're not polite at all. In fact, in my book, I talk about the Swedes as being in the public sphere, the most rude people I've ever encountered outside of Hong Kong Chinese. They're incredibly brusque and bad-mannered. You know, if they don't know you on the buses, on the trains, out in public, they use their elbows without apologizing. They don't hold door. You know, they're really, really shockingly rude from an English perspective. And I'm not the only Englishman who's noticed this. So, and that, maybe that's the Viking gene coming out there. I think the whole Viking thing is rather overstated, actually. This was something that happened 1,000 years ago. But, you know, we were learning more and more about the Vikings, about what a complex, actually very civilized people they were.
Right.
But I'm not sure they were more brutal than anyone else.
I'm speaking with Michael Booth. He's author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. I want to get back to a phrase that I mentioned when I introduced you that really caught me reading the book, benign totalitarianism. You weren't the first to use the term, but it really struck me. What is the argument there that Sweden is in some ways a totalitarianism society?
Well, we're familiar with the concept of a totalitarian state as one with a one-party ruler that dictates, you know, how the country is run.
Right.
Now, Sweden's social democrats pretty much did rule the country for the vast majority of the last 50 to 80 years. So, and yes, there was democracy. Yes, there were elections. But as is the often happens when one party has a lot of power, they took over the judiciary, they took over the media, they took over academia. So social democracy became the national creed, if you like. And so the benign part of it is, you know, they weren't queuing for potatoes like the Russians were. Everyone had a nice car. Everyone had an extremely high standard of living. So again, the wealth was distributed extremely effectively, and they had this fantastic cradle-to-grave welfare state and safety net. So that was the benign aspect of it. I have met Swedes who have complained that they don't feel particularly free when they're in Sweden, and have they indeed left Sweden, because certain freedoms are not officially curtailed, but if, for example, you want to be a mother who stays at home to raise her kids, that's not particularly approved of, and the social systems don't particularly support that. So yeah, you're free, but you're free to be Swedish.
To keep the analogy going a little bit, you know, censorship, I suppose, would be a big part of a totalitarian state. And there has been this sort of agreement not to give a far-right party, the Sweden Democrat Party, very much airtime during the last election. Now, what's the story there, and does it make sense? Does it not make sense?
I can see both sides of this one. You know, the Sweden Democrats are a pretty odious bunch. They have their roots in the neo-Nazi movement in Sweden. They're bigoted, anti-immigration, particularly anti-Muslim. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed them. They're not particularly appealing, and they have kind of stupid and ridiculous views. Now, to put it bluntly, now in Sweden, none of the political parties will work with them. They've been shunned in parliament since they came in the election before last, actually. And the media has kind of self-censored them. So some newspapers wouldn't accept their adverts. They were excluded from debate programs on TV on kind of spurious grounds. Now, this has kind of backfired because they scored 13% in the last election and have a bigger presence in parliament than ever. And there is a sense that that view, that whole dialogue about immigration has become a taboo, and it's rather exploded in the Swedes' faces. This is certainly the view from Denmark, where their own right-wing party has been much more a part of the mainstream for the last 15 years. Indeed, for a lot of the last 15 years, it was the kind of the kingmaker in the government.
And this is the whole, I mean, this is the difference in terms of how we all view freedom of speech. You know, I mean, we know right now we've talked a lot about Charlie Hebdo. The Danish cartoons came up after that. And it seems like there is a very different idea of what freedom of speech should be in Sweden versus in Denmark and versus, I suppose, in the UK and the United States.
Absolutely. And that was really epitomized just a couple of months ago, actually, by a Swedish artist called Park, who, based in Malmö, I believe, created some pretty offensive works of art with showing black people being lynched and really unpleasant art, actually, if you could call it art. His works were confiscated in Sweden, and he came, I think, to live in Copenhagen or spend a lot of time in Copenhagen. And here people tried to put on a show of his work. And even a state-sponsored radio station promoted him and kind of championed his cause. So the Danes have a very different view. They have a kind of anything-goes view in terms of free speech, unless it comes to criticizing their queen, of course. You're not allowed to do that.
So do you have any ideas after writing this book about why the Western media does tend to see Sweden and, in fact, the rest of Scandinavia through such rose-tinted glasses when there is racism, xenophobia, you know, things under the surface, under the main narrative that we would find anywhere else? Why do we see it so perfectly?
Well, first of all, I think they fulfill a need that we all have for a utopia, right? A utopia on Earth. And since the economic crash and the euro crash, we used to dream of a house in Provence or Tuscany or wherever. I think we kind of shifted our eyes north because they offered us a different set of values, a different kind of way, a formula for running society that seemed less capitalistic, less grasping, more functional, more simple, that kind of back to basics thing. And then there's what I call the White Album argument, right? Paul McCartney was once asked by a journalist, he said, shouldn't the White Album have been maybe just a one disc album instead of a double album? Because there were some, you know, filler songs on there that weren't that good. And McCartney said, well, yeah, but it's still the White Album. And, you know, when you say that there's racism and there's xenophobia up here in the North, there is, but not that much compared to other countries in Europe. And things still function extremely well here. These are, you know, I live here of my own free will. It's a great place to live. It's safe. Things work. It's fair. It's equal. And I don't really see anywhere else that's doing it any better.
So as close to perfect as we'll find.
As I say, the book's called The Almost Nearly Perfect People. And I do, you know, sometimes I'm very critical because the media asks me to be critical. But that is genuinely how I feel about these countries.
Well, Michael Booth, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome, Taylor. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Michael Booth is the author of The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia. And you can find more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, you can't bring up Swedish culture without bringing up its contributions to the world of pop music. While ABBA's catalog may be the first songs that come to mind when you think of Swedish pop, the Swedes have been involved in way more hits than you might realize. Take Taylor Swift's most recent album, 1989. 9 of the 13 tracks on that record were co-written by Swedish producer Max Martin. But that's not the only pop song Max Martin and his gang of Swedish artists have helped produce. Here's just a sampling of the many, many, many hits they've brought to the U.S. over the years. So Sweden may not be a perfect utopia, but they do know how to churn out a good dance beat. We'll stay in Scandinavia for a bit longer to uncover a growing trend among the DIY set, IKEA hacking. Instead of following the assembly directions, some people are opting to use IKEA's raw materials to create their own customized furniture. And we'll hear more from that story when Word of Mouth continues.